before.
The last newspaper article I read on this said that you're at risk as far back as 15 years. So I'm kind of curious about how many people at the Oregon State Pen have since 1971 been monogamous, not involved in any drug usage, and you are in there for forgery.
If I can clarify that 15 years, I think that was a projection of the latency period of the disease. I don't believe anybody has changed the projection that the virus was first introduced into the United States in the mid to late 1970s. That's the cutoff period we look at.
Okay, but there may be a whole bunch of people out there that are, in fact, carriers of the disease that are unaware because of the long latency periods.
That is true. And but again, they're identifiable by the behaviors they've practiced in the intervening years. Multiple partners, use of drugs. And in Oregon,
doesn't that cover quite a few people in our society, Christy? I mean, it's a shame, but I mean, it does cover quite a few people out there, doesn't it?
It does cover quite a few. And the trick is trying to figure out ways to wisely invest our public funds in both educating everybody that there may be quite a few people who are infected and you better watch your behavior all the time, and testing appropriately those who are clearly likely to have been infected and for whom knowledge of their test status will make a difference in the education program.
Okay, I just have this vague disquiet that the Health Division's attitude towards this problem, as evidenced by this bill, is not much different than the letter to the editor I saw the other day that said the cure for AIDS is abstinence. While it might be, it's pretty impractical, and I'm not so sure that this bill, you know, really moves us in any direction.
This bill is not, in and of itself, an answer to AIDS. This bill arose out of some look at the statutes associated with AIDS and led me and others to say, we really better go to work on these statutes. But if anybody thinks I'm presenting this statute as Oregon's answer to AIDS, I have done a very bad job in my testimony today. Oregon's answer to AIDS is in $1 million in expenditures for education and for testing, in an extensive network of community service organizations in our 36 counties where our local health departments are doing these. It's a whole other arena of activity. This is just one little piece that addresses some statutory provisions that seem to be appropriate to get in place.
Okay, one last question that I'll have for Kristen. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I attended a legislative breakfast out in my district, and a fellow legislator who go unnamed brought up this situation. Said he was called by a restaurant owner who was concerned that if one of his employees had AIDS and a customer caught the AIDS from the restaurant, who would be liable? Now, I indicated when I, you know, I had to respond to that comment because I found the comment, at least with the information that I had, uninformed. I indicated that the only way that I knew that this disease could be spread, according to the testimony, medical testimony I'd seen, is the same as what you indicated, blood and semen. Now, is that correct?
Yes.
That only through those two avenues can the disease be spread? That if I am an employee and have AIDS, there is no likelihood that I can spread it to any of my fellow employees. Is that correct?
That is correct, unless you have a very peculiar job, which involves the sharing of blood or semen.
Right. Now, my question then, if that's the case, my question is, on page 64 of your report, you have, under recommendations, number 4, in cases where testing is appropriate, persons expected to submit to testing must have prior notice of the test, etc. If testing is permitted as a bona fide condition of employment, under Health Division rules, all persons employed in the identified positions must be subject to the testing. Now, what is all of that, unless you're testing prostitutes? What are we talking about there? If your comments earlier were correct.
That is a follow-on to item one in that same list of recommendations, which said that if there are any conditions of any places of employment where testing would be bona fide, the division should identify them by rule. And then if we did the other ones, there are none. And I think that was a part of one of Representative Gold's questions earlier. We do not at this point identify any occupations that we would apply this to. It may be at some point in the future. We might learn something different about the disease or about some occupations. Were prostitution to be recognized legally as a legal occupation in this state, I suppose that would be the one example I can think of, and where then such a rule might apply, because it would be a bona fide condition of employment that you would be, in fact, putting people at risk for this disease by doing what your job required.
You would not at this time be in favor of any legislation that said if you got busted for prostitution, one of the things that would happen is that you would automatically be tested for AIDS.
I haven't looked at a draft of such a statute. The problem with such a statute is that would get such a small percentage of the prostitutes, only those who happen to get convicted in any one period, that I'm not sure what it would accomplish.
I understand it may be a small group of people that are actually participating in the selling section of prostitution, but my understanding of the employment of prostitutes is that they may, in a very short period of time, have a great many people involved. So we're talking about a much larger group.
Yes.
Now, is it foreseeable that the health department will, in the future, be looking at legislation like that?
Yes, it is foreseeable, because prostitution is the next major item on our AIDS Policy Committee agenda. And we will be looking into that. And the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are looking at prostitutes and the risks. So there certainly is a possibility that we would seriously be looking at testing of prostitutes within a reasonable period of time.
And as we're waiting and we're looking, additional people may be becoming infected on a regular, on a basis right now.
And many people would say that is the best example around of a person knowingly putting themselves at risk of a disease, because use of a prostitute is generally an informed act of a consenting adult. And so the question is asked, what is the role of public health in protecting a person from that level of personal risk-taking? Certainly a reason to continue looking at our education program as well as looking at the prostitutes specifically.
So the letter to the editor was correct. As long as we all abstain, we're all safe.
And don't use drugs.
And don't use drugs. Thank you, Chris. Any other questions, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Schubert. Just one comment, and I don't want to belabor the issue, but remind the committee that Oregon had the first workers' comp claim for AIDS. A nurse handling blood contracted the disease because she poked herself with the needle. So she may have been a very virtuous woman, but still ended up with the disease. So it's very complicated, and so there are other ways to contract it that we might not even realize.
Is that Representative Shipwreck? Is that case has been filed?
It was compensable, yes, it was.
It was compensable.
You bet. She was infected with it.
Did she know that the person that she was dealing with had AIDS?
I don't know. I can't remember. It was a very unfortunate episode, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Agar.
I know we're not in work session or anything, but I appreciate the opportunity to point out a point of discomfort that I have for whatever use it may be, and that is the whole issue of the toxic substances. Now, we have regulation by the Department of Environmental Quality. I believe we've passed worker right-to-know laws that presumably would come under the Department of Labor. And now here the health department would also have some statutory authority with regard to these toxic substances specifically expressed. And I guess my discomfort is who would be doing what, what kind of integration would there be, if there would be, of the various efforts? Would the responsibilities among all of them be sufficiently cleanly defined so that we're not stumbling over one another, or we don't give the impression of expanding turf, you know? And I just have a vague sense of discomfort related to that whole subject because I don't understand.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ford.
Mr. Chair, in response to Representative Agron's concern, I share it too. This may not be an appropriate time to include that in this legislation. However, somewhere in this building, during this legislative session, a committee will be dealing with a bill that came out of the interim Committee on Government Reorganization, and they are going to be looking into the whole idea of combining the DEQ and the Health Division into it would be a Department of Health and Safety, I believe is the way it was termed. That is going on somewhere here now, and because of the great overlap, and also because DEQ really is supposed to be there, again, for the safety, health and safety of the public, and sometimes it gets the public has the impression is there just strictly as a regulatory agency, and they want to stress the health and safety factors.
If I can, you know, I have the extreme pleasure. Representative Ford is correct. It's House Bill 2030, and we have it, and it will be heard on April 17th.
So the deadline day.
That's right. Okay, if there are no other questions for Christy, thank you very much, Christy.
Thank you.
Linda Allen. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Allen. I'm the director of the Jefferson County Health Department and chairperson of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. My comments will be very brief. Christine, as the expert on this bill, has more than adequately described it to you. We are, as local health departments, in favor of combining statutes for one uniform communicable disease code in this state. The separation of venereal disease from the communicable disease statutes implies that venereal diseases are not communicable, which indeed they are. And from the local perspective, having them combined in one uniform statute would be a workable solution for us or situation. We further, in particular, favor the strengthening of the confidentiality. We believe as health professionals, we have a responsibility to protect and maintain an individual's right to confidential health care. This is very specific, as Christine said, in the VD statute, not so specific in the communicable disease statute, and we believe that that should be strengthened to cover all communicable diseases. Mr. Chairman, I would be less than honest with you if I said there were not some concerns at the local level about the legal process outlined for quarantine. I would also be less than honest if I told you that I was the best person to address that in detail. I am not the best person to detail those concerns for you. I believe you do have someone on your list of testifiers who best details the concerns of some local agencies as regards the process outlined for you. We do want to make it very clear, though, that we are very concerned that people's right to due process and that their rights for, you know, non-discrimination be protected and observed. But the legal process is problematic in some areas, and there is another person that will be testifying on that in greater detail.
Well, let me, since you brought it up, let me ask you about that. You said you had some problems with the quarantine area of the bill. Do you have the bill in front of you there?
No, I do not. Mr. Chairman, some of the members, we represent, by the way, the 33 local health departments in the state. Some members in our group have voiced some concern.
What I'm trying to get at, what specific concerns do we have?
There are some current concerns about the it being a more cumbersome process than is now in place. There are some concerns that even though we have, as you heard, have a history of very few quarantines being implemented in the state, less than 5 year, maybe two. There are some concerns, however, that this legal process does add to the very limited service, add cost to the very limited service dollars that most county health departments are feeling throughout the state.
Okay. One of the observations I had when I was reading this is it seemed to me that in order to satisfy the due process provisions of Section 10, it would take me longer in number of days than I could get the quarantine for, which is only 60 days. Then I'd have to go through the process again. Because as I go through all of these pages, I've got hearings, I have delays, etc. The need for the quarantine in most contagious diseases would be long past by the time I got through this process.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you have hit upon the concerns as expressed by some of our membership. I believe there's a 72-hour process there, three affidavits. It involves the sheriff's department. It involves assigning legal counsel, etc. You have hit upon one of the concerns as verbalized by our membership.
Other questions for Linda? No, thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
Jane Cummings? Welcome to the Human Resources Committee, Jane.
Thank you. It's my first time being here. Good afternoon, Representative Katulski and members of the committee. My name is Jane Cummins, and I am speaking to you today in my role as the chair of the Public Health Advisory Board, which, as you know, is the advisory board to Christine Gebbe. In my normal day-to-day work, I am a hospital administrator in Portland. The disease control statutes in Oregon are currently divided between chapters 433, as you're aware, dealing with general disease issues, and chapter 434, which deals specifically with the venereal disease. And HB 2067, as Christine has so adequately described, proposes to consolidate and standardize those two chapters and to modernize them. It also includes specific due process protections when restrictive measures such as quarantines are required that haven't been present in the existing law. And the origin of HB 2067, as I understand the history, came in good measure from the recommendations of the AIDS Task Force, which, as you know, also was a multidisciplinary, multifaceted task force dealing with many of the issues surrounding the AIDS problem. I think it was quite impressive in its thoroughness and its objectivity. And a member of the Public Health Advisory Board, Mr. Goldthwait, was in attendance at all but one of those meetings, and when he was unable to attend, we sent Dr. Bill Fisher, another member of our advisory board, to that meeting. And the recommendations from that task force were presented, thoroughly examined, and endorsed by the Public Health Advisory Board. One of those recommendations of the task force was to revise the venereal disease statutes to make them more applicable to the current situation that we find ourselves in. And it was upon further study of the health division staff that it was found that the venereal disease statutes themselves were antiquated and that it was more appropriate to meld the two existing chapters. The Public Health Advisory Board discussed HB 2067 at our most recent meeting and endorsed it, and I'm speaking on behalf of the board unanimously in support of the bill. We feel very strongly that the confidentiality and due process provisions are necessary safeguards for all concerned, and that the language keeps Oregon in the forefront with regards to progressive public health matters.
Questions?
You
got off easy, Jane, for your first time. Charles Schrade? Your handwriting is such, Charles, I'm not sure, did I get that?
You did it just fine. That gives me the opportunity to point out that I passed handwriting destruction 101 with flying colors in medical school. My name is Charles Shade, and I'm a county health officer from Multnomah County. You may well ask, why did I lug this huge notebook up? And the answer is that this notebook contains the 1983 version of public health laws in the state of Oregon. There is a moral to my tale, and that is this book is thick enough for a local health officer, a local health administrator to try to cope with. I am one of the individuals that Linda Allen indicated had some concerns with the proposed revision of the quarantine law, and one concern I have is that although the first five sections, which combine and coalesce statutes in an appropriate way, actually remove redundant material from the statute book, the last sections of it seem to be going in the opposite direction and produce a body of very complicated law, which I question my own ability to cope with. I should point out that Multnomah County's Board of Commissioners is on record in support of sections 1 through 5 in its legislative addendum. I am not sure how our board would react to section 6 up, because they weren't under consideration, and indeed there weren't even a gleam in anybody's eye, so far as I could tell at the time, that our board made some reflections on what it wanted to do about legislative policy. So I'm not speaking for Multnomah County except in the most general sense about the last few sections. I can certainly talk to how they might affect my ability to function as a health officer. Another issue is one which I'd like to say is I don't deserve this. About a year ago, I wrote our county council a memo supporting an approach to dealing with the tobacco problem that she thought was novel. What I was going to propose doing was classify tobacco products as vectors of communicable disease, that disease being, of course, lung cancer. The county council didn't think much of my attempt to to bring tobacco control under the wing of the quarantine law, but I see that Mrs. Gebbie has attempted to do the same thing with her introduction of toxic substances, and I certainly salute the health division for finally waking up to the fact that tobacco is a problem in this state. What is the purpose of the last few sections of the bill? What is the purpose of quarantine? The purpose is a police power. It's a police power just the same as you give the local sheriff. He draws a line and says, you know, there's something going on beyond this line, so you all stay back. And for the most part, quarantine authority is not something that's fought out in the court, but something which, as some on your committee have suggested, occurs fairly quickly and often in the heat of some sort of dispute. Such disputes that might arguably be swept into this law include the restaurant worker with hepatitis. Right now we tell them to go home, that's pretty clear. There happens to be an administrative rule to that effect. You can't work in restaurants when you have hepatitis. I'm a little concerned about how this new quarantine law might interact with that situation. A worse example, and one which concerns me directly, is how to deal with situations like tuberculosis. I am the guilty party, the person who has written most of the quarantine orders in the state of Oregon in the past 5 or 10 years, with the exception of the big typhoid outbreak that occurred in Marion County a few years ago. The quarantine orders I write usually deal with people who have active tuberculosis, as Mrs. Gebbie has said. And they are mainly aimed at reinforcing the person's natural inclination to do what is appropriate, that usually is dampened by his propensity to drink. Most of the tuberculosis patients that I've had to write quarantine orders against have had a concomitant alcoholism problem. And because their alcoholism problem, it has been difficult sometimes to persuade them to stay in the hospital, or it has been difficult once they've been released from hospital to be sure that they stay in their room. So I use a quarantine order in selected cases where a person has indicated both by his demeanor and by his activities is not going to simply stay put because I've asked him to stay put. I use a quarantine order in that situation relatively effectively, and it's cheap. Those orders are not written with the intervention of the court. I know both of the cases in Multnomah County in which we have actually picked up people from the street and detained them in the past 10 years. One of them was a woman with active contagious tuberculosis of the most serious type who was literally lying on the sidewalk, drinking herself into a stupor and coughing all over all the passersby. She refused to go to the hospital. We made numerous attempts to intervene and finally went to court, got a warrant, got her taken to the hospital and treated. The other situation was more recent. I had a person who had failed to complete treatment for tuberculosis. I had allowed a certain amount of time to go by. I judged that it was possible that this individual was now contagious again, so I asked him to come in for follow-up. He refused. I wrote him a letter. He ignored that. I went to court and got a warrant and got him brought in by the sheriff, and he did at that point submit to an x-ray examination, a sputum examination. The good part of the story is he was not contagious then. He's now free going about his business. The whole intervention on his personal freedom took the order of 15 or 20 minutes, and I think it was a good investment of public time and effort. But a very infrequent thing, because lesser measures almost usually work. Now,
Before you go any further, I need to have just a point of clarification here. All right, you've indicated that in the proposed bill we have a cumbersome process. Now, you indicated that you go to court and get these orders. What's the difference? I'm not sure I understand the difference between what you do now and what occurs in this bill. Can you, in your testimony someplace, I'd like you to get down to specifics.
I'm glad you asked that question, because in fact I agree with a number of people who are advocating for this bill that we have less than perfect due process protection in the current law and in the current administrative rules. The Health Division has proposed administrative rules which I think answer the due process questions, but attorneys who are pushing the stronger legislative solution will tell you that maybe it doesn't, and I think you need to hear both sides and make up your own mind. I am not an attorney, and all I can say is I think I could live with these administrative rules. The difference is one of when you need to go to court. My concern is keeping most technical matters, most medical matters out of the hands of the court, i.e., if you're not going to pick somebody up and detain that person, we need to make every effort to keep from having arguments before courts of law when the matter really is a medical matter. The way things work currently, we're quite successful at that, though there's clearly written in existing statute a right to appeal to court. What is not written in existing statute is a requirement to notify a person of the right to appeal, and that's something that needs to be fixed, whether by these rules or by statute, because an individual who has his freedom impaired, even to the extent of my telling him to stay in his apartment for 2 weeks, really needs to know that if he disputes it, he can argue about it.
Dr. Shade, I'd like to refer you to Section 11. On page 9 of the printed bill, which states that without necessity of first filing a petition and affidavits, and then skipping down a few lines, for individuals who are a clear and immediate danger to other individuals or the public generally, the assistant director or local public health administrator may direct a sheriff or other peace officer to take the subject into custody, and the peace officer shall do so immediately. Do you not interpret that as preserving your emergency powers to pick someone up?
I'm not really concerned about emergency powers, because I think when there is an emergency, we've had extremely good cooperation with the court as it is. I'm not even sure that it would, since these are so infrequent, I'm not even sure it would be necessary often enough to have a special section of statute to tell you how to do that. What I'm concerned about is that this emergency powers procedure does set the whole mechanism in operation. And what from an administrative standpoint, I want to do is keep the number of times that this big, complicated machine runs down to an absolute minimum. Number one, because it's going to be expensive to run, and number two, because the outcome is less certain. The outcome is quite certain if by some means it does not take you into a court of law, you are able to get the correct behavioral outcome. And I've found that by issuing an appropriately worded quarantine order that simply tells a person what he's got to do and gives him some notice about what he can do if he doesn't like that order, similar to what we do under the immunization law right now, which says quite clearly, you know, your child isn't going to get into school if you don't. And if you don't like this order, look on the back and you can figure out how to appeal it. I think that is a much more satisfactory administrative approach than having to go through this rather difficult process, which, because of its costliness, would probably provide a strong incentive not to get involved with quarantine actions and might result not in the most serious cases being overlooked, because in the most serious cases, we will take whatever action is necessary and expend as much of the county's budget as we can get away with. But the most serious cases are not the situations where the quarantine authority is of most use. The quarantine authority